SIBO. Geez, see, I finished with it how I started. I'm not gonna edit that out either. I'm gonna keep it in there. Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Great Things with Great Tech, the podcast highlighting companies doing great things with great technology. My name's Anthony Spiteri, and in this episode, we're talking to a company whose vision is to create a flexible cloud platform featuring, but not limited to, Kubernetes, created by developers for developers, a company that thinks that you should spend less of your time managing environments and platforms and instead focus on coding. That company is SIBO. I'm talking to Mark Boost, the CEO of SIBO. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here and talking to you today.
Excellent. So, Mark, just before we get into all things Kubernetes, I just wanted to shout out again, and for those that love great things with great tech and would like to feature on future episodes, you can click on the link in the show notes or go to launch.gtwgt.com and register your interest. And just as a reminder, all episodes of GTWGT are available on all good podcast platforms. We're talking Google, Apple, Spotify, all of those popular ones, all hosted and served from anchor.fm. And just as a reminder, to keep up to date, you can check all the show notes and all past episodes are up on the website as well. So with that, Mark, let's talk about SIBO, and I am pronouncing it correctly, not Chivo, like I have forced myself to not do, like we talked about earlier. SIBO was founded in 2016, bootstrapped by the founders, of which you were a co-founder, and just came out of, I guess, you know, beta earlier this year into sort of early availability stage. But really, maybe just give firstly a bit of background about yourself and then talk about the early days of the company and why you decided to go out with your co-founders and found it.
Sure, yeah. So it all started... actually, just jumping slightly back before there, I guess maybe just a bit of background about me growing up. Was definitely brought up around computers, and my father was a programmer himself. So yeah, he was bringing back PCs back in the 80s, and I was exposed to that at 10 years old, and he was showing me things, and you know, obviously brought up playing games and stuff like that, and
very similar.
And just being curious. And I remember him bringing home modems before the internet, where you used to have bulletin boards, and I was messing around with modems, and I was dialing in back in the dial-up days. If anyone remembers that, we used to dial up to people's computers and connect to these bulletin boards. And then eventually, I think I was about 14 years old, I actually started up my own bulletin board. Nice. And I managed to convince my dad to get a dedicated phone line, because we needed that, obviously, not to tie up the main line for the house. And people could dial into my bulletin board, which I created and developed using software that was already out there, but you customize it heavily to be right for kind of your users that are coming on there, and they can join the bulletin board, and you know, they can play games, they can download free software, they can in a way, there was a kind of a form of dropping someone a message, and then you had to log off, and then someone else had to log back on and collect that message. It was kind of like the early days of email and things. You couldn't, it wasn't like real time. And so I was kind of doing things like that when I was growing up. And then I actually got into motor racing as a bit of a sideline, and had about 4 years of motor racing, getting to a fairly high level.
Okay.
And then that kind of dried up through lack of sponsorship. And I had to make a decision of what to do in my life. And at that point, I fell back on the tech that, you know, I've been passionate about growing up, and I decided to start a web design company originally.
Okay.
But quickly branched out when I realized that, you know, with web design, it was quite tough dealing with customers with their, you know, changing demands and things, that, you know, the customization and the backwards and forwards and scope creep and all this kind of stuff was quite tough. So in a way, we diversified quite early to offer domain names and web hosting.
Yeah. This was LCN.
Yeah. So initially it was more aimed at helping our web design clients host their websites. Mm-hmm. But then it really got to a point where we said, you know, and this was me and a couple of the early employees, you know, saying, why don't we just launch this separate website that just focused on only the domain names and the web hosting? And so we set up a dedicated website. It was called Low Cost Names at the time. We eventually rebranded it to LCN. and it sold domain names and basic budget web hosting for startup businesses and, you know, email accounts, that kind of thing. That grew really well over kind of 20-year period. It grew to be the fifth largest hosting company in the UK.
Well, okay.
We had about 400,000 domain names under management. And I exited that business in 2018. Okay. And really that's what a lot of that funding was then used to bootstrap, you know, the Sivo. But the journey kind of started before that. We're, you know, already I was thinking about Sivo, and we've, like you've mentioned, we founded the company in 2016, a couple of years before that LCN sale. So we're already developing the technology and things. And actually LCN was our first client. So we were actually providing the some of the hosting for LCN, and it was originally based on OpenStack.
Yep.
It's not today. And that's part of the reason why we were, before we actually launched into beta, you know, we were actually developing something for LCN, hosting that, managing that, and learning. And I mean, then we got to the point where the LCN sale kind of happened, and then we were focusing on Sivo as his own business to grow as his own cloud provider.
Yeah, that makes sense in terms of the timelines there. And there was a couple of other companies as well that you were involved in between, like sort of in that sort of, there's like a history of 2006, 2014. So A Network, Server Choice, and Bulletproof. They were all kind of, you had your hands in all that as well.
Yeah, I suppose you can call me a bit of a serial entrepreneur, but I've always believed in diversifying and, you know, not sitting still. And we were doing the budget hosting with LCN, and it just felt like we should have more of an enterprise offering.
Yeah.
So that's when Server Choice came in, and it was more cloud hosting, you know, managed hosting for cloud, you know, for enterprises that had bespoke requirements, that had, you know, higher levels of uptime and service level guarantees and things, as well as we built our own data center where people could actually host within our data center. We still got that data center today, and Server Choice is still one of the companies in kind of in our group, if you like, as well. So that still lives on. And really the Bulletproof and the AI networks kind of spun out of Server Choice. One was a connectivity provider that provided high-end connectivity to, you know, to buildings. And the other one was cybersecurity. And that was really because we were getting requests at Server Choice saying, you know, could you help with our connectivity? Do you do cybersecurity? And then we said, look, let's focus on those areas as well. And I've always been a great believer that we could have done that all from one company, but you end up being perceived as like a jack of all trades and not a master of any one of those. So I've always believed in having dedicated brands and specialists. And we actually saw, you know, huge change in growth when originally we launched our cyber security services, for instance, into Server Choice. But it wasn't until we launched Bulletproof with its own brand that it really started to take off, because it was perceived as a dedicated cybersecurity company.
Yeah.
So that's when, we kind of set up Sivo as its own thing. We could have done it within Server Choice, but we felt like it needed a unique brand, its unique identity, and not sit, you know, it was doing cloud native and things, some, you know, new technologies. So to sit that inside something that we're also doing, you know, data centers and legacy, you know, kind of stuff, it didn't feel right. So we wanted to move that in to its own brand.
Yeah. And I mean, it completely makes sense in terms of the background that I'm hearing about now, in terms of, you know, where Sivo has come from and how it's evolved. You know, you can kind of see it there in the history. What made you go down the path of, number one, looking at Kubernetes as a service? We'll talk a little bit about that ecosystem and where it is a bit later on. But what made you sort of go from, okay, we might look at OpenStack, that looks interesting. We're not going to do traditional, you know, we're not going to go down the path of infrastructure hosting that a lot of other companies are doing. We're going to look at this open sort of stack-ish situation, but then to sort of settle on a Kubernetes as a service. But not only that, you've really settled on something that's very unique and different with regards to, you know, K3s and also, you know, really enveloping this, the OCP or the Open Compute Platform as well. So what was the journey to get yourself to that point?
Yeah, so probably when we first started it, we did start with an infrastructure as a service offering, and which was doing traditional VMs. But that was mainly because we were building a service for LCN at the time. Mm. And that's what they were selling, you know, VPS style hosting, you know, cheap and cheerful stuff. And it was really that once the LCN sale happened, it was then, okay, let's go back to the drawing board. Let's look at our competitors and people, you know, where could we differentiate? Where could we stand out from the crowd? And obviously there's loads of infrastructure as a service providers. And then obviously Kubernetes adoption is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So then we really said, okay, look, I think we need to focus on Kubernetes. Then we started looking at the competition in Kubernetes and saying, well, you know, how could we stand out from the crowd? And that's really where we saw an opportunity with K3S. We were already users. Some of our developers internally were already using K3S in its early stages and loved what it was doing. You know, a small install, they could install it on Raspberry Pis and this thing.
Yeah.
You know, dead easy, you know, not complicated to install and get running. Yet you had kind of, you know, full Kubernetes that was more complicated, took, you needed a bigger amount of server resources to get it running and various things like that. So we looked at that and just felt there was an opportunity to, a few different reasons, really. We've always, all of my companies that I've started, have always had this value of simplicity. And there we saw an opportunity with K3S saying, this is really easy to get started with. So, and we like the speed of it as well. It, you know, it's a small installation, so we felt we could install it really quickly and get people up and running quickly. So, yeah, we launched a service based on K3S, which meant that at the moment, sub 90 seconds, we can launch a full Kubernetes service for anyone. And it comes with that bundled with a certain amount of components out of the box. So it's not just, launching a Kubernetes service from another provider and having to set up various different other components to get it working, that you could actually just go to our control panel, launch the service, and have a fully working Kubernetes service with your ingest controller and everything ready to go in that 90 seconds. So we just felt that was an opportunity. And then as K3S has evolved as well, because when we were first working with it, it was pre-GA.
Okay.
And that was during our beta period, early stage of our beta period. And obviously it's come on more and more and more. And then really there's, you know, from our point of view anyway, there's certainly, we believe there's nothing you can't do with K3S you can't do with K3S. And we've proven that. But we actually think it offers an opportunity for people to develop faster and deploy faster because they can spin things up, spin things down, you know, a lot quicker. And on top of that, the simplicity and the cost element, because it uses less resources than full K3S. So there's actually a cost impact that you could, save some money. And it just, like I suppose, all those disruptive things put together just felt it was something that was right for us. And we're not ruling out actually launching a full Kubernetes service in the future. Mm-hmm. But we felt for where we are in our journey, there is a path. And even if we do launch a full Kubernetes service later, we still think there's a path there for a low cost, very quick, you know, developer friendly, lightweight version of Kubernetes for people to use for certain scenarios.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because I was going to ask it later on, though, in terms of, you know, K3s versus full-blown Kubernetes, like in terms of what you perceive, or, you know, you guys, what do you gain from, well, I guess it could go either way, what do you gain or lose, but what do you gain from going to a full-blown Kubernetes as opposed to K3?
Well, not so much as you used to, because they're almost coming together a bit more, you know, in terms of both evolving. It used to be that full Kubernetes had lots of bloat in it related to various different storage providers and things for cloud services and things like this.
Yeah.
But now it's all going down, a different route with the CSI drivers that's standardizing the way it's working. So in a way, they're coming a lot closer together. And what we've done with K3S as well, we've kind of done our own customized version of K3S. So it's not like the K3S you're going to install on your Raspberry Pi, we've actually built a control plane around it that provides the high availability functions and things that you expect of, you know, for Kubernetes. We've extended some of the other functionality to, as part of building our own custom operators and things to make it work how we believe it should work. You know, so it's our kind of our own kind of version of that.
And I think that's a good point, Rob, because I think and I was guilty of this when I first heard about you guys and looked you guys up and I thought, well, okay, Sivo doing stuff with K3S. I thought, okay, well, they're deploying a bunch of Raspberry Pis and they've got like a bunch of Raspberry Pis in a data center somewhere and they're using that for hosting. I thought that was it, right? And I think, and actually, to be fair, I think some of the other people that I've chatted to them about you guys, that's their perception as well. But as we'll go into later, it's absolutely not that, right? But, you know, that's what I think I have in my head. When I think about K3S, you know, ARM-based processors, Raspberry Pi sitting on a shelf, like those, like you talked about modems, like the old early days of the internet, we had modems sitting on a shelf, right? I kind of thought about that, but that's not what you guys are doing. Just before we get into that, I just want to go, and I usually touch on this at the start, but is the name significant at all, or is it just a name?
No, it's just a name. Yeah, people do ask me that sometimes, but I guess from my domain name days, you know, I actually registered quite a few different domain names that I had future uses for. And I just like the sound of Sivo. It was a short domain. I always believe in having short domains. You know, our cybersecurity brand is Bulletproof, for instance. You know, it's a great name. We've got a new service actually being launched called defense.com, you know, as we've got that domain name. And so I'm always a believer in good domain names that sound right. AI Networks, one of my other companies, was AI.co.uk, you know, and Sivo is just another name that I thought, well, one day I could use that for something. It wasn't particularly, we did have a little play with, could we create something around the C is cloud, the I is innovation, the V is virtualized. I don't know, you know, but in the early days we were thinking about how we could use it, but there wasn't a story behind it, in all honesty.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think the last company I had on was, they were named after some sort of mountain range in the home city of the founder or something. And, you know, you get all these funky names, but then again, you just get names that make sense and that's it. And let the marketing guys deal with the creativeness afterwards, I say. So you were in beta for a while. So you came out of beta in May of 2021, moved to early access, you know, but in the beta, you had 5,000 beta testers during that phase, you know, from effectively all around the world. How did you build that base to be able to test out, you know, the platform before you came out of beta?
Yeah, the demand was incredible. It was bigger than we expected. I mean, when we first set the early version up, and we posted out on social media as you do, we did post a few ads out as well, you know, on different platforms, mainly kind of Twitter promoted tweets and you know, Reddit ads and just things like that to try and get some traction. The response was incredible. And I think there was a certain amount of, you know, word of mouth around that as well. We accepted 5,000 beta testers. You know, we actually hand vetted every user. We asked them why they would be a good beta, you know, user, you know, what their experience is, you know, what they could bring to the beta, and were they willing to contribute. Obviously, a lot of people, a certain amount of people would just give either no answers onto that, or they would put some, you know, some rubbish in there. So they didn't obviously get on the beta. So we had 5,000 people accepted, and there was probably another few thousand that we didn't accept. The support that we got from people is actually, you know, I don't know, it's the first business that I've run that's been more, you know, from the outset, we've been, I guess, involved more in open source and kind of the kind of community, the cloud native communities and things like that. And it was amazing for me to see how humbling that people were willing to help us, support us, write about us, give feedback, contribute code. And actually what happened from that is we ended up employing quite a lot of the people that were beta testers.
Yep.
You know, Alejandro, who's with us now still, he started just working off his own back, building a Terraform provider for us.
Yeah.
And we were like, wow, you know, why is he doing this? You know, it's kind of amazing. Is that, you know, I'd never seen this before. And I found it incredible. And, you know, he was from Cuba, had a hard life there, you know, in terms of, you know, rations for food and various different things. And him and his family were struggling, and he was working for a company at the time doing 18-hour days, 7 days a week, this kind of stuff. And we said, look, you know, why don't you join us? And in the end, we ended up getting him a visa. We paid for his visa.
Wow.
It took us 2 years to get it. We moved him over because the pandemic delayed it all.
Yeah.
And eventually, about 3 or 4 months ago, we got him over here. You know, we've given him a better life and we've given him back because he reached out, he was helping us. And, you know, so I wanted to repay some of that favor, but that was just one example.
Yeah. That's an amazing story of, you know, just the world today. It's very representative of the opportunity that exists in the world because of the technology that we sit on, that we live on, that's been created over the past 20 years, you know. Who would have thought that you'd be able to do that, you know, when you first started, you know, back in the early days. But I think that speaks to culture as well. And you guys have got a pretty interesting culture. You were talking about that. So maybe, you know, before we dive into a bit more of the tech stuff for the listeners, let's talk a little bit about the culture, because I you mentioned it earlier to me before the show, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. With all the companies I've always founded, you know, we've had a good culture and I've learned so much over 20 years about how to build a good culture and how to try and, you know, reward people and motivate people and all that kind of stuff. But it's been the Sivo experience, again, has been a very much a learning experience for me. And because it's yeah, a lot of the other businesses, I would say, were very commercially focused in a kind of different way. You know, the type of customers and the way we sold to people was very sales led, if you like, you know, a lot of the times. And to get involved in the kind of cloud native communities and open source communities and things taught me quite a lot as well. And I said, like the experiences with Alejandro and so we've tried to, you know, give back and trying to help people. We're great believers in hiring people and finding a place for them that they're comfortable and almost writing their own job description. And I think that's meant that with people do what they love and what they enjoy. And we've actually moved people around as well, where we felt like they weren't, you know, giving their best self and doing the best job. And but then we said, you know, why don't you try this? And then they've loved it. And we're trying to put the right pegs in the right holes and not, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think that's one of the first things that we're trying to get right. And because if you love what you do, then you give your best work.
Yeah.
So that's the thing, first of all, that we've tried to do. And then on top of that, really, it's giving people the freedom to express themselves, not micromanaging people. And empowering them, you know, to do their best work. So you give them guidance and you know, you don't set rules, you set guidelines and you help and support a mentor, but then you give them the room to grow and do their best work without having to sit on their shoulder. So we've had that sort of culture that we've built from the word go. We always talk about succeeding together and failing together. You know, there's no blame. You know, if something goes wrong, we learn from it, but we're not pointing the finger at anyone, you know, and hopefully there's times when things go, you know, very right and we enjoy it together as a team. And I suppose the other thing is kind of reducing that. I'm a great believer, you know, in terms of sharing the prosperity between employees and not having a wide pay gap between, you know, more senior staff and newer staff. So that's been a thing that we've brought in. And we've shared, we've already given a lot of the shares to employees within the company as well. And I suppose the last thing to mention, we trialed over the summer a 4-day week,
okay,
which
yeah.
has been very successful. Employees love that kind of freedom.
Yeah.
Most people take in the Friday off, but we had to do...
I was going to say, what day becomes the day that people take off?
Yeah, most people are Friday, but because we have to have staff cover, you know, more, we kind of have the whole company off on Friday.
Yeah.
Some people swap and they do the Monday and someone covers the Friday and that kind of stuff. So we do swap it around a bit. But that's been really successful. And we haven't seen a productivity drop. You know, that's the first question people ask me, you know, how's productivity? But it's interesting because I think what we've done is made adjustments as well to make that work for us. So, you know, we've tried to say, look, because we are working 4 days, you know, we want people to maximize those 4 days and work as efficiently as they can during those 4 days. Let's not have long drawn out meetings, you know, let's try and keep our meetings shorter. Let's, you know, so we've made adjustments on to make it work as well. I don't think it's a simple case of saying, drop from 5 to 4 and your productivity won't drop, because it might do. But I think what you do is you say, look, let's get the balance right for people, that work-life balance. So if people want the freedom of the Friday off, then there's got to be that give and take as well to try and say, let's really focus on these days that you're in, you know, and get the focus right. And so I think there's a bit of figuring that out and trying to get that right. But in the main, the people love the freedom.
Yeah. So, okay. It's cool. I think it you can kind of see that in the service that you guys are offering, and the way that it's presented, the way that you've conducted yourself on the socials and the community. I think it's very reflective of that. Very much like this, a modern company, you know, and it's also reflective in the fact that you are doing something fairly, I would say, cutting edge and modern as well in the space, right? So I think all these pieces, you know, pretty much fit, and it makes sense. Just finishing off, so you had a great year this year. Obviously, you went into the early sort of access. You've got a even better sort of second half of the year /Q4. You just released your German region. So currently, before that, what did you have? You had a couple of American and a UK region, or is there something like that as well that you had when you launched?
Yeah, we've got one US and one UK.
One US, UK.
Now, now in Frankfurt in Germany.
Yeah, good stuff. One coming as well?
One coming in Asia in the next few months.
Awesome. There you go. So yeah, it's going to be all around the world basically down in a couple of months. But, you know, you just had a funding announcement as well and a strategic partnership agreement, which happened in September. And you're officially launching, at the time of recording this podcast, KubeCon North America happens next week. And you're going to be launching officially in the GA at KubeCon as well. So was that just always the way it just was naturally going to happen at that big event, or what was the theory behind that?
Yeah, I think so. The strategy we've kind of got, and I'm arguing there's other people in our industry that are similar, but we've decided to use the KubeCons, really, the European one and the US one, as key launch time. So obviously we launched at KubeCon EU into early access, and now we're launching GA at KubeCon. It's just a good chance. It's a big event. You know, obviously there's a lot of publicity around it. We can build on that as well with some of the things that we do on social media around KubeCon and things. And so it just feels a natural time to kind of announce that in a way. So, and really we've been kind of production ready, you know, since May, because we went into the early access, but I think we were still treading carefully in those early days to make sure, you know, everything was absolutely perfect and perfected before we officially go into GA. And we wanted to also gauge demand. When you went into the early access, we were kind of thinking, what happens if this really blows up, you know, in terms of, you know, tons of people flood to the platform. Can we control that demand? Can we scale quick enough? Yeah. Can we do this? Can we do that? So we wanted to get a slightly slower pace of sign up. Let's do an early access phase. Let's make sure we're fully comfortable. We've got, you know, we've bedded everything. We've got all the features that we think we need. And then once we're comfortable, we're then moving to GA. And we feel we're in that good place
now. Still traditional issues in hosting, right? Like how scale, growth, it still doesn't change. I mean, even the big guys, the public clouds, they have their scalability issues. They run out of resources. I mean, I think Azure in the UK famously ran out of compute, networking runs out. So it's something that happens even at the biggest, you know, scale. So for you guys to have that as well. I mean, on that demand, you know, obviously you guys sort of positioning to cater for developers. Is that sort of where you want to be? Like, where do you guys want to be? Because I see your platform, I see the pricing is hyper aggressive in terms of, you know, comparing it to the other sort of public clouds out there and other managed Kubernetes services. I think the lowest node you can run is like $4 a month or something like that. And obviously, you know, it scales up from there. Who are you trying to capture firstly, I think? And then secondly, is it going to be a situation where you want, you know, bigger enterprises to be running their applications on your platform? Just where do you guys sit?
I think in the early part of our journey, should we say this, you know, the part where we're in now, you know, we're trying to connect with developers. You know, we're trying to, you know, gain their respect. And I think we've been doing that, you know, to a certain degree, you know, what I said before, but some of the feedback we've had from people in the way we've gone about things, the simplicity, you know, how we make things easier, the developer tools that we've bundled in and things to make this come to life. I think we've got that, you know, really, really well defined, and we've got it spot on. And we don't want to forget where we've came from, you know, the beta testers, the people that helped shape where we are, developer community. We want to keep investing in grassroots and helping and in people's learnings. And, you know, we've got our academy and things like that as well, which we may talk about in a minute. But I think there is a next stage of the journey at some point as well, where, you know, we will start to launch other services. You know, for instance, we're already POCing a GPU as a service.
Okay.
And yeah, we've got our database as a service coming. We're looking at a platform as a service product. And we, as I mentioned before, we may look at a full Kubernetes. Yeah. You could argue, you know, more enterprise version with, you know, certain more enterprise features.
And you, so got, think, and you guys do instances as well, right? So you're kind of at the moment, you're doing Kubernetes clusters, you're doing instances, but, you know, you've got pricing at the moment for your future database services and everything else that you said. So yeah, you're already kind of not just this one trick pony offering a Kubernetes cluster. You're already doing some different things, but you know what you've just said means that you're thinking quite big.
Yeah, and I think the other point as well is that I honestly believe that the hyperscalers are charging people too much. You know, so I think that's the benchmark. We're really cheap, but are we really cheap? You know,
interesting. I agree.
The benchmark is quite high. You know, so
that's a really good point. That is a super good point because I've been out of. Obviously, people that listen to the show know that I used to work for a hosting provider all my career before I joined my current company. And I remember during the 2013, 14, 15 period, we had tons of people moving from our platform to the hyperscalers. You know, it was up to AWS to Azure. By the time just before I left in about 2016, we were migrating customers back because number one, it was a lot more expensive than what they had been paying with us. Number two, the performance wasn't as they expected. In fact, it was tons worse, but the price was the biggest reason for them to pull back. So you've really made an interesting point. Like have we just become desensitized to the price that is the public cloud with the hyperscalers, because it is what it is, because they've got the marketing, they've got the budget, they can push it out there, and they hit the CEOs, they hit the CIOs, and that's who dictates, you know, what happens underneath that. That's a really good point. And it's not in our industry, it's never a good thing to be seen as the cheapest. Like that's got that stigma attached to it, right? So you want to kind of be in the middle there where you want to be offering quality services at a good price and not always be seen as the cheapest as well. So a couple of points there.
Yeah. It's definitely a balance in that. We've gone, quite aggressive. To start with, we're trying to build our name. We want people to use our platform. We don't want them to put off. We try and, on purpose, not to directly compete with hyperscalers. You know, we're trying to distance ourselves from them. And certainly not just the price, but it's about the predictability. And I think anyone that uses a hyperscaler, you know, struggles to kind of determine what their bill might end up each month. And I think that's a big problem. And we've seen that our firsthand ourselves. You know, we've used hyperscalers in the past, and you know, it's very easy to click a wrong button here and there and run up a big bill before you even know it. And it amazes me that there's, you know, if you did a search on Google for AWS cost savings or something, you'll get about 5, 6, 7 ads from companies that are set up purely to help you save money on an AWS bill. That's, which I think is a crazy concept.
Damning, right? Yeah.
Yeah, to say that. How's that even possible, really? You know, that we should have a service out there that's that complicated to get your head around that you can't work out what your bill might be each month. So I think we're trying to take that simplicity and predictability into that as well.
And that's exactly what it is, right? Like I said, I've used the platform a couple of times. I've been on it for a while, and it is just simple. Like you said, within a couple of clicks and sort of 90 seconds later, you've got your first nodes up and you're kind of deploying your apps. In terms of how you've been able to get this cost point, I mean, some things have gone into that, right? Obviously, the K3S, like we've talked about, From the hardware platform itself, you guys use the standardized design, open compute platform. There's a great YouTube video that you're on as well, where you show a time lapse of a rack being built and the open compute platform and what it actually means. I mean, it's a big rack with lots of, like, I guess we call it blade servers that fit in there, all pre-configured. The rack gets shipped out to the data center, you turn it on, you run a bunch of automation with Ansible, it configures everything and everything's kind of ready to go. So you've really thought about how you can streamline the process end to end, also leverage things like open compute platform, which, you know, like I mentioned to you earlier, when we were talking, was, you know, that I remember hearing and getting approached by that those guys back, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years ago to say, hey, look at us, what we're doing. So how does that help you guys? Like, what's the biggest benefit in using OCP to basically host your services?
Yeah, there's probably three benefits that I can think of. And the first one is that it perfectly fits our and a kind of model, the way we want to work, which is simplicity. And in the way we deploy our hardware, we want something very repeatable. And so we've used, it's all software defined rather than, say, we're buying, you know, well-known brand servers, and Dells or HPs or whatever, you know, with all their trying extra software they're trying to put on there, or they're trying to, you know, sell their kind of, you know, switching with whatever software and this license for that and the support for this and that kind of stuff. So, you know, we're just buying, you know, chips really, and we're then putting our software and our stamp on that. Yeah. So straight away we're reducing a load of cost out of that, but we're also defining our own future, and we're just treating it as a stack of hardware that we get in a rack that's easily repeatable. And the way it works is really cool actually. We're planning on doing some more videos around this, but awesome. And it touched on it in that video that you've seen already, is that a rack gets literally shipped from the UK in a crate, fully loaded, already built offsite, and it gets flown to anywhere in the world. We don't touch it. We arrange with couriers and people to deliver that at the other end. The data center partners that we partner with, we have a really strong relationship to make sure we pick a data center with very strong you know, remote hand services, so they can collect that rack, they can plumb it in the power and the connectivity that we've already pre-purchased.
Yeah.
And then it literally, once it is connected, it phones home and it self-installs all the software on there itself with under 20 minutes, and our full Kubernetes stack is up and running, ready to take workload. Yeah. And I think
one and it of really does always- like it really does. And you know, I'll post the video. It's the stuff that we only dreamed about just a few like years ago, right? So kudos, like, for me to be able to see that. I must admit, I got a bit jealous because I've been, again, a bit hands off over the past 5 years or so, and I miss being in a data center, but I miss being part of that process. That was that innovation. So yeah, I kind of felt a little bit, you know, a little bit jealous of it, right? It was it was really good. And you know, just speaking to that as well, I mean, you mentioned it deploys all the Kubernetes. It's full Kubernetes. Like, there's no sense of any other virtualization on there now. Everything that you're doing is full, like even the control plane, I suppose, that, you know, that installs everything onto the nodes. It's all based on kubevert, and you've got the instances there. So even when you're building your tenant or your customer in, clusters, that's all on kubevert as well, isn't it? So there's nowhere where you're kind of leveraging bare metal. There's nowhere where you're leveraging any other hypervisor. You're all kind of keeping it in this Kubernetes sort of ecosystem.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that we believe strongly in, that you know, we're carving ourselves out as to being the cloud native host, you know, in terms of that's all we do, you know. So yes, you can get a traditional VM from us, but it's delivered through kubevert, so it's running Kubernetes, you know. So you know, and the services that we launch in the future, the GPU as a service, we've already been talking to NVIDIA in terms of providing that with Kubernetes. They've already built a load of Helm charts themselves to you know, installing all their tools and all their kind of example learning you know, algorithms and things to and that's, they've got a marketplace already for that.
So what's the use case there? Just out of interest, sorry to cut you off. I just had a thought, because I've just been listening to the concept of what the GPU is doing versus the CPU and the use cases for the GPU. But is it for more your AI and machine learning use cases? Is that sort of what you're targeting there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're quite fortunate enough that our location in the UK is very close to Cambridge University, which is, you know, world renowned, and there's a lot of Cambridge. They're big into the machine learning and all the AI stuff. And you've got all these startups that are spinning out of Cambridge. Mm. And there's like 400 of them or something, you know, in that area alone. So we're actually very closely, we're only about 10 miles down the road from that whole scene. You know, so we know already that we can sort of plug into that environment, but then we can, once we're plugged into that environment and those sort of companies, we can replicate that into other countries. And, you know, we've got the case studies and all the things to show that we're good at this sort of stuff. So we're already working with piloting this with some of these companies.
Yeah, good stuff. And let's just
mainly on bioscience.
Okay, bioscience, interesting. Yeah, that's right. That's what I thought it was. Yes, that's really interesting. Again, to their point, if you can do it at a price point that fits, you know, the advantages that you guys have gained, that's where you're going to do well in it as well, right? And they don't have to go to the hyperscalers and buy GPU off the hyperscalers. They can use you guys because you guys have been able to, you know, make this better at a price point in a more simple way. It totally works. Just wanted to wrap off a couple more things before we kind of, because we, again, like I say on all my shows, almost we could talk for hours. I wanted to talk about the fact that you guys have really focused on learning the academy. I think also to that end, that kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that you've really focused on your API, your CLI, which makes things a lot easier. You've got obviously, but then again, you've got the web, which is very intuitive and simple and gets to the point really quickly. But if you want to dig into a bit more hands-on CLI, you've got that opportunity. You've also got the infrastructure as code. You mentioned the Terraform provider, Polini, cross-play. Like you've got everything going there, right? As well as a marketplace, which I think is unique in itself from a managed Kubernetes perspective. I haven't seen that just yet with a very complete marketplace. So all in all, you've been able to wrap up a lot of the tools that the people that you're targeting, the devs, and this open source community love to play with. So, and that's a really big, you know, part of, I think, your success in that beta moving into the early availability. But how do you see the learning and the academy component of that? Why have you fought? And you're not, it just seems to be a common theme in the Kubernetes space, the learning and the academies. But what's your take on that? Why do you think it's so important?
I think it's mostly important because Kubernetes can be quite daunting to a lot of people. And there is a lot of complexities when you first come into it. And we've done a survey, actually, in fact, because there's some research you can download off our website around the complexities and what developers are finding is that there's that steep learning curve. And I think a lot of companies are going to work out where they want to be with Kubernetes. You know, do they want to run a big cluster themselves? You know, do they want to learn all of it inside out, all the networking nuts and bolts and all the different components and things? Yeah. Or do they actually just want some containers? You know, do they want to be able to run the basic, you know, I want Kubernetes, but I don't want to manage Kubernetes. You know, so I think what we're, the academy is there really to support the learnings of people. But we've also got something called KubeQuest, which is really popular. And that's really about, it's like a challenge of 5 steps of actually learning about using Stevo and Kubernetes to, you have to pass certain things. But yeah, that's kind of where it started first. And then because we've got this big community, you know, people are asking us about learnings and things. And we feel like we have to, you know, I said earlier about being true to our community and keep that going and investing in grassroots. We want to have those learnings there. And I think the job we've done is pretty good. It's had a lot of recognition. Yeah. Because I think there's a lot of Kubernetes stuff out there, but it's bits and bobs.
Very
and
much
there's
so.
60, oh, 60 different videos covering core topics.
Yeah.
And it's all free. So I think it's just our way of giving back. And obviously, yeah, of course, there's it might help us grow as well, because if we can you know, resonate with people early on in their learnings, whether they're a student or whatever, then maybe one day they say, you know, when I'm working at this company, they might recommend Stevo. And that's all we ask, really.
That's good seeding. Yeah, that's great seeding. I think you mentioned another great point there about, you know, the two types of people, I think, in this world. And it's very representative of the different communities that exist in terms of the developer open source community. they just want to get to the nuts and bolts, and this just, well, they want to get in to develop their applications as quick as possible, as easy as possible, as portable as possible, and get it into a staging and into a production environment as quickly as possible. Whereas I think guys like more me, who have been more platform focused, virtualization, we like to get underneath the surface and dig a lot. You know, if we've got like a black box, you want to see in that black box, right? That's just the way that we're kind of, I guess, wired. However, I'm not so sure that's really the best way moving forward. You know, and a service like you guys, what you guys are doing, it, I think, justifies what I've been thinking for a while, and that I don't have to know every single bit about what makes Kubernetes run, right? I just need to know enough to be able to, you know, talk a bit about it, but also then understand that from my perspective as an infrastructure guy, understand that when a developer deploys something into a cluster somewhere, I need to know a little bit about how that runs so I can get to the application, what components are inside the deployment, the namespace, understand how I protect that data, and then go from there. But I don't need to get as deep as I had to, because that world effectively has moved on a little bit, right? I think that's where the academy and where the learnings come into play as well.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, the way we kind of like to think of ourselves internally as well is that it's kind of, you know, Seagull is the cloud, but in the how you want it. So if you're someone that's, you know, deep technical, you might want to use some the CLI or the infrastructure as code or whatever. But if you're, you know, a beginner, you can just use the web UI. Or you've got the marketplace there to just install things for you, so you don't have to install these things on your own. There's 80 applications there across the common sort of stuff that people use.
Yeah.
So I think we're trying to say it's cloud, but your way, and just reduce that simplicity. But I think even for experts, I mean, no one wants complexity in their life for the sake of complexity. No.
Yeah, the older I get, the more I understand that. I want simplicity the older I get.
Yeah. So I think it's about productivity. I think it's coming, especially for companies, it's coming down to product. They want productivity. They want to deploy faster, you know, write more code, ship it faster, that kind of stuff. So I mean, that's our kind of vision, is to try and just make it easier, take that friction away. And I think, as I said, our survey proves that there's a lot of concern around complexity and the steep learning curve around Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. So if we can help companies reduce that friction, then we can, developers, they can, you know, ship code quicker.
Yeah. All right. We just might finish off with one last question, just around the state of Kubernetes in general as a service, managed Kubernetes offering. There's a ton out there. A few that have done, and I've had a few on the show that do things slightly different. You guys are unique in that you're the first pure play that I know of anywhere in a sense, right? So what's your general take about the current ecosystem and where you see it maybe in the next, say, 2 to 5 years with regards to traditional virtualization infrastructure as a service providers? Are they going to pivot to this more pure Kubernetes as a service, or is it going to be the new guys like you guys popping up and kind of replacing them and displacing the customer base that they have at the moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we're all trying to look into this crystal ball and predict that future, aren't we? You know, and we even have differing views internally, you know, about what routes should we go down? Should we do this? Should we do that? You know, where we need to be. There definitely seems to be a consensus that there's a lot of complexity out there, you know, and, you know, not just from our survey, as I mentioned, but I think there's a lot of, you know, talk about more, platform as a service type offerings coming out, you know, maybe container as a service rather than full Kubernetes, you know, just trying to take some of that away. But it might still be Kubernetes under the hood. You know, they've still got all the good stuff around Kubernetes, but almost managed by your service provider. You don't have to worry about it. So yeah. I think there's a general consensus that we're moving a bit more that way of managing. You know, it kind of happened with hardware, didn't it? You know, we all used to be in the data centers with cage nuts and screws and things and screwdrivers and that. And then it went virtualization, and we never really went to the data centers and things. But we had to manage all the hypervisors, all the operating systems and all this kind of stuff. And now it's going to containers. We don't have to worry about all the patching and operating systems and things like that. So I think it's a natural evolution that, you know, are we all going to want to manage all this, Kubernetes stuff, or do we want to trust maybe to just, you know, there's some more machine learning stuff coming that's going to, you know, do this for us and automate a lot of these things. I mean, you trust the technology. trusty automation. So I think that's the way it's heading. You know, I don't want to say too much about what we're going to do, but we've got a few ideas about how we can, again, make it simpler, but with the power that some people want still, without losing that. So we've got a few things coming next year that that we're working on that could potentially try and get a bit of the best of both worlds, where you can have you know, the simplicity, but with the extra features that some people might want, or access to certain things that they want.
I get it. That's a great look. Again, if everyone knew what the crystal ball was, we probably wouldn't be sitting where we're sitting. We'd probably, you know, it's that Back to the Future almanac situation, right? If you knew it was going to come, you'd be a very well off and rich person. Good stuff. All right, then. Well, look, that's great. I think this has been a great conversation, because I think we covered more than I had hoped, in terms of, you know, we covered everything from culture to, you know, how you guys started, to the technology that underpins Sivo. It's a really fantastic platform. I believe, you know, obviously, again, you guys are launching at KubeCon. I believe you've got some deals going on in terms of, you know, the first month for, is that going to continue moving forward in terms of the 250 credit moving forward? Is that something that'll be short term, or, you know, that's a great introductory way to get people on as well?
Yeah, we're not going to remove it anytime soon. So we obviously want to encourage some people to try it. So we want to give an incentive there for people to try it.
Awesome. Good stuff. All right, then. Well, look, I'll link to the show notes about you guys, put some notes in there, put a link to that YouTube video, which shows the construction of the rack and how you guys are working with OCP, because I think it's a really awesome video and actually literally steps through the configuration of that rack. I wish you guys all the best in the future. I'm really going to keep an eye on what you guys are doing, and wishing you guys a really good KubeCon next week as well. So thanks, Mark. But I'll just finish off by saying once again that if you're not subscribed to the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast station, and go to the website at gtwgt.com. So once again, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Chivo. Sivo. Geez, see, I finished with it how I started. I'm not gonna edit that out either. I'm gonna keep it in there. But thanks, Mark, and we'll see you next time on Great Things with Great Tech.
Thanks very much.
No worries. All right. Very good.